Here's something that's been true for centuries. Dictators and conquerors generally don't like to be challenged. And they don't like it when there's a wealth of written knowledge that predates them and challenges them and sometimes contradicts them. And so, at different times in different cultures since the printed word was first printed, there have been attempts to destroy any record of the past that might challenge what the new leaders have in mind for the present and the future. It happened in China around 200 BC. In fact, Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi not only burned books, he was also said to have buried 460 Confucian scholars. A little bit of overkill. It happened to the Library of Alexandria in Egypt. More about that in a minute. It happened under the Roman Emperor Constantine, as he embraced a particular doctrine of Christianity and wanted to wipe out other contenders. It happened to the Aztecs and the Mayans under Spanish conquest, and it happened in the 20th century under the Nazis and the Khmer Rouge. And just in 2012, Islamist militants tried to destroy ancient manuscripts in Timbuktu in Mali. But the badass librarians there, I'm borrowing a phrase from Joshua Hammer, who wrote a book on this incident, came together to save hundreds of thousands of these documents, sometimes floating them down the Niger River on longboats to safety.
These manuscripts are clearly symbols of open-mindedness and reasoned discourse. You know, in ancient times, they show that at that time, Islam was a religion of tolerance, that it coexisted perfectly with science, and that probably is very threatening to the radical Islamists that we see today.
This is Kathleen Lowe, the Africa Project Manager at the Center for Fine Arts in Brussels, speaking on the World Radio Program in January 2015. She had helped put together a Timbuktu Renaissance exhibit, which was open at that time. The badass librarians of Timbuktu knew the value of preserving the accumulated knowledge and opinion and debate of the past. And now, at a time when the U.S. president calls journalists the enemy of the American people, when his aides argue with straight faces that there are alternative facts, when ordinary people are left to figure out what's fake news, having a record of it all matters for us now and for those who will come after us in this century and beyond to try to figure out what on earth we were thinking. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this episode is about another badass librarian with big ambitions to make all human knowledge universally available online. He works very close to where I live in San Francisco. I'm in an interesting neighborhood. I'm a short walk from a view of the Golden Gate Bridge near a trail called Land's End, which overlooks the Pacific Ocean. Generations of Russians and Chinese have lived here, and more recently, Burmese, Vietnamese, and Koreans. But one of the most interesting things about this little corner of San Francisco is a building on a corner shaded by spreading cypress trees. It's gleaming white and imposing with Greek-style pillars. It used to be a Christian Science church, but now a discreet sign outside informs passers-by, this is the home of the Internet Archive. Go in the front entrance, and you may see volunteers unloading books and others sitting at scanning machines, digitizing them. You may meet Internet Archive founder Brewster Kahle, an MIT-educated computer engineer, internet entrepreneur, and digital librarian.
Internet Archive. So we're about 140 people, about half scanning and half working in places like this, and these programmers and administrators and librarians. Here we've got machines for digitizing videotapes of all sorts of different eras. I can show you our book scanners. And we have scanning centers, 29 scanning centers in 8 countries, trying to just bring things online.
Brewster leads me up some stairs and opens the door to a room bathed in muted light, streaming through stained glass and falling on wooden pews and an altar in soft whites. Behind the pews, at the top of the rake, sit banks of servers, humming gently, lights flashing.
Wow.
So when we bought this building, we thought we'd flatten the floor and make it into a library, but we thought we'd adapt to it slowly. And so These are actually servers of the Internet Archive.
Oh, that's great.
So every time a light blinks, is somebody either uploading something or downloading something from the Internet Archive. So you can actually, I think of it kind of like OpenStax books, where the books glow when somebody's reading it.
Brewster has an infectious enthusiasm about this project he started 20 years ago, and a playful approach to it. We walk down the aisle to the front of the church, where on one side, there's a little army of statues of people. He says it's a riff on China's terracotta warriors, but...
So they're us. We worked for the archive for 3 years. We make a little statue.
That is very cool.
Yeah. Well, it celebrates the people that are putting their lives into the public sphere. And we're in Silicon Valley, where is the land of get rich quick, but not in a nonprofit like the Internet Archive. You're not going to get rich. That's my statue. I'm next to Ted Nelson, a fellow of the Internet Archive, and he came up with the concept of hypertext that, you know, is the foundation of our world.
So the hymn numbers are up there.
But we're geeks, so we changed the hymn numbers. Do you recognize the number? 3.1415.
Oh, pi.
That's harder one.
161?
Yeah, 1.61. It's harder.
You're not going to tell me. Okay, so math was never my strong suit. But I did look it up when I got home. 1.61 is the golden ratio, just so you know. I looked that up online, much as I might once have looked it up in a library, but much more quickly. As we all know, the internet has arguably put more knowledge in more hands than just about any other single human invention. Of course, it has also made it much easier to put out misinformation and propaganda and spyware and viruses. The Internet Archive seeks to preserve web pages of all sorts that might be of value to future generations, or even to ours, especially in a time when some might find it politically expedient to remove or change websites and claim the earlier versions were never there. So, how can alternative facts be countered with facts? How about with something called the Wayback Machine, a play on the contraption designed by the talking dog Mr. Peabody for his adopted boy Sherman in the 1960s cartoon series The Rocky and Bullwinkle Show?
Happy birthday, Sherman.
Gee, thanks, Mr. Peabody. Well, what is it?
Well, actually, it's a time machine. I call it a Wayback. We just set it, turn it on, open the door... and there we are, or were, really.
The Internet Archive's Wayback Machine does this with web pages. It saves different versions of them over time, including the ones some people would prefer to wipe from history. Among its fans is MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. This is her on her show in late 2016.
The Wayback Machine, it is a national treasure. It's an international treasure. We have used it hundreds of times. Probably thousands of times in the preparation of this show. Anytime somebody tries to make something go away, that's the first place you look to see if you can find it, despite the efforts of the person who tried to disappear that information.
For instance, she says, how when Mike Pence was first running for office, he proposed that rather than allocating money to help people with AIDS, that money should go to cure people of being gay. Or when Donald Trump was first elected president and he put a page online called Meet the President-Elect, promoting his business interests. Both pages have since been taken down, but they live forever on the Internet Archive. You've got to wonder how people like President Trump and Mike Pence and Steve Bannon feel about not being able to control the public record. In fact, Trump mentioned something a little disturbing when he was campaigning on December 7th, 2015.
We're losing a lot of people because of the internet, and we have to do something. We have to go see Bill Gates and a lot of different people that really understand what's happening. We have to talk to them, maybe in certain areas, closing that internet up in some way. Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Okay, so aside from the fact that it's a little chilling that the guy who's now president calls defenders of freedom of speech foolish people, have you noticed how many of Donald Trump's references are a decade or two out of date? Bill Gates stepped down from Microsoft in 2000. He's now running a foundation focused on global public health. Another Trumpian trope that I've noticed happens a lot is that he acts like we're all groping in the dark. He says things like, we need to ban Muslims until we know what the hell is going on. Or, we need to talk to these people, these very few people, who understand what's happening. But that's the thing with the internet and libraries and learning. We're all potentially empowered to find out a lot more than many of us do. relying too much on authority figures to shape the contours of our world for us, to tell us what to believe and what to fear and what to give up so we can feel safe, has not always served us well. And it's not how a democracy is supposed to work. Each citizen is supposed to be informed and involved, and not just informed by websites that reinforce existing views without any real basis in fact. The Internet Archive exists to try to help citizens of the United States and throughout the world be better informed, better able to draw from deep wells of knowledge, and to expose attempts to hide past actions about which the public has a right to know. That starts with the Wayback Machine, and so does my conversation with Internet Archive founder Brewster Kahle.
That's how most people think of the Internet Archive, as the Wayback Machine. But it's actually much more than that. We're trying to build a Library of Alexandria version 2. So can we make all the published works of humankind available to people permanently? So all the books, music, video, web pages, software, lectures, available to anybody wanting to have access.
So the Library of Alexandria, you've talked about in the past, it has particular resonance for you, particular meaning. Why?
That was the last time that someone tried to collect it all together. It was the center of learning in the ancient world. They were agnostic about where the information came from. They wanted the works from the Hebrews, from the Hittites, from the Greeks, from the Romans, and they brought it all together and they made it so that they could learn from it. And they came up with great things. Geometry, they knew how that the earth was round and how big it was within a few percent. They figured out all sorts of things by being able to bring all of this information together. They built a global brain.
So what happened to the Library of Alexandria?
It dissipated. Yes, there were burns, but the Greek ideal of encyclopedic knowledge was replaced by a much more narrow view of what it is knowledge should be. And it was in the first couple centuries AD, it basically was replaced by a much more religious structure, and it wasn't Islam. That didn't start until 600 AD.
This is a polite way of saying it was the early Christians. It was Emperor Constantine and after. It was the start of the Dark Ages. The Internet Archive is now housed in this building that looks a little bit like the old Library of Alexandria, and Brewster has big ambitions for what the Internet Archive may yet become.
We could actually outdo the Greeks. So the Greeks had the concept of encyclopedic knowledge, but they had it all concentrated in Alexandria. Can we make it so that there's universal access to all knowledge is the opportunity of our time. And that's, I think, a fulfillment in some sense of the Enlightenment ideal of the individual and education, the public library, but redone now in the digital age. So we need to get all of the analog material, books, music, video, online and accessible, but also all the born digital materials. An average life of a web page is 100 days between when it's changed or deleted. That's it. It's the most ephemeral of media. So we collect the web at 1 billion pages every week. We have now over 500 billion web objects that we've collected over the last 20 years, and we've made the Wayback Machine that allows people to have access to this. And we get hundreds of thousands of people using it every day, which is kind of exciting that people want to have access to this.
So you're copying all the time because obviously there's digital decay, right?
There's several things that contribute to rot or loss. There's bit rot. There's just hard drives going bad. There's also format shifts, so you just can't read it anymore. But I'd say there's other areas. There's corporate and copyright and protections that go and keep things from getting copied or used, and so that they just disappear and slip away. There's institutional failures. So libraries just go away, or you think these companies will just stay around forever. Or parts that Apple had, Mobile Me, they said that was a service that you could go and do your home pages on them, and then they just turned it off. And there's only one copy, it's in the Wayback Machine. Or Yahoo Video, they had that, and only copies in the Wayback Machine. Google Video. Before YouTube, there was Google Video. It had 6 million videos. Only copies in the Wayback Machines. So even successful organizations turn off services. This is the form of digital loss that we're seeing happening at a scale that people just are having a hard time fathoming. Can you imagine if YouTube turned off or Flickr turned off? I mean, they will. It's just a matter of when.
I know one of the challenges you've dealt with over the 20 years that you've been doing this is copyright. Like, you know, what are you allowed? What are you able to put on the Wayback Machine? How do you approach that question?
Libraries have always been full of copyrighted materials. Everything that's in a library is copyrighted. It's just thinking about what a library in the digital era means. And it's key to try to stay away from interrupting people's commercial interests. But exactly how you do that varies. So for instance, in the Wayback Machine, we collect everything unless people contact us and say, please take it out. And so we do take things out of the Wayback Machine, but by default, it's all in. We also collect television 24/7. We collect television from Russia, China, Japan, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, ABC, Fox, 24 hours a day. We make only the US television news available searchably, but you can only get a minute or so off of television archive, tv.archive.org. If you want the whole thing, we put it onto a DVD and send it to you, and then you have to send it back. Why? It's a library. You're borrowing it. It's a little clunky, but it's doable. If we take books, for instance, so we've been digitizing books with about 500 libraries around the world. We digitize 1,000 books a day. We've got 2.5 million to 3 million books that we've already done. And the idea is we're trying to get to 10 million books, which is a Yale, a Princeton, or a Boston Public Library. At that point, I can sleep and go and say, yeah, we've got it. But then what do you do about the modern books, the books that are still being sold or at least under copyright? We lend them. We digitize and lend. We have the physical book, so we lend one copy at a time. So if one goes to openlibrary.org, you can borrow a book for 2 weeks. And while you're reading it, other people can't read it unless you've returned it.
Do you have a sense of how sort of demographics and geography break down in terms of your users? Is it pretty evenly distributed around the world? Is it mostly Americans? Is it mostly younger people? Are you able to find any of that out, or you just know the number of how many people are using?
We know remarkably little of exactly where people are or where they come from because we eliminate and we never collect the IP addresses of people that come to us. We specifically ignore who it is that's using us to be able to protect reader privacy, because we do get demands sometimes from law enforcement that want to know about the patrons of the Internet Archive. And it's very helpful to just say, we don't know. And it's not like we aren't going to tell you, it's we don't know. And they just turn around and go away. And sometimes they still come and demand things. They give us one of these national security letters where he has a gag order where they demand information. And the only reason why I can say we've gotten them is because we fought them. And we fought them and won. And the libraries have a long history of dealing with authorities that have come and rounded up people for what it is they've read and bad things happening to them. It's haunting to librarians. So we take reader privacy extremely seriously. The downside is we're not exactly sure who's using us unless they come forward and say why it is they're using us. And people use us to go and find their own old web pages, their own old information. They use us to go and make things permanent that they think should be made available to others because there's an upload button on archive.org. There's people that use it to find old scientific papers, and right now we're getting a lot of hits to the epa.gov site for some of the old papers they had on climate change that are no longer on their website. So those are the uses that we know of, but that doesn't explain the 5 million users that are using the information resources of the archive.
How do you fund all this?
The Internet Archive is funded mostly by libraries paying us 10 cents a page to digitize books, because we digitize 1,000 books a day and make them available. They also pay us to collect web pages for us, like Library of Congress or National Archives, and about 500 other libraries do. And we also get about a third of our income from donations. So people come to archive.org and hit the donate button, and the average donation's on the order of $25. And we just finished a major round of fundraising at the end of the year to go and try to make a copy of the Internet Archive to put into Canada, and got halfway to our $5 million goal.
When you started this, was this your vision that it would have gotten this big, that it would have become the central depository for all kinds of activity on the internet and on television, and that you'd have this many millions of people using it on a regular basis?
I thought that when we started the Internet Archive, that a lot more people would copy what it is we're doing, but we're still pretty unique, which is sort of exciting, but a little depressing. So we've had to grow into a much larger organization than I thought we would have to. But it's still a fun and interesting endeavor. The web is not boring in any sense, and the internet is still an exciting area to be working in, and it's still morphing and changing. What do we do about mobile now that, you know, so much is in apps? What do we do?
What do you do?
It's a struggle. I mean, those are very locked down, very closed environments. The Apple iPhone is all, it's locked. It's sort of the absolute opposite of the dream of the internet and the World Wide Web. So how do we adapt? We're trying to figure out personal digital archives. People are now putting their own personal materials and really trusting that Flickr is going to be their repository of their family photos forever and ever. And so organizations like ours goes and tries to archive it, but you know, Flickr is just too big. We can't get a hold of all of it, so we'll get a hold of the popular things. But how do we deal with, as people are becoming more and more trusting of these corporations to store their memories?
But in terms of just amount of data, is it in petabytes? Is it in, and where are we at the moment with this?
The Internet Archive is about 30 petabytes of data now. So it goes mega, giga, tera, and after tera comes petabytes. So it's a big number. It's 30, and we're doubling about every 2 to 3 years. But it's still manageable. That's not big by the big boy standards in terms of like the Googles or the Amazon.coms. So it is completely within range to be able to store that much materials. But it requires an active community and an active interest in building universal access to all knowledge.
So there was an instance where the British Conservative Party took 10 years worth of speeches offline, or wanted them taken offline. When something like that happens, I mean, if it's the British government or the British Conservative Party, perhaps it's one thing. If it's the Chinese government, it might be another. How do you deal with attempts to just sort of clean up history or censor?
I think it's all evolving, and especially right now, this is a new administration that's very media savvy. They're very aware of the power of media and how to manipulate media. And we're adapting, and the whole internet is adapting. So in general, we'll take things out on government websites out of the Wayback Machine when we're contacted. And even when we're contacted, we'll even sometimes push back, so that the idea of the public record can't just be erased from an increasingly important digital record of the, whether it's tweets or web pages or YouTubes that have been put out as propaganda or statements or promises that you may want to go back and change. That's a little Orwellian. The world is still moving along and evolving of how do you make permanent public access to materials in such a way that it's not threatening to you. I mean, the flip side of people saying, well, you can't have access to that, is maybe there's too much access to some things that are sort of private data, and it sort of feels creepy out there. And so we're all learning, and we just want to keep a lot of this discussion happening in the public sphere, in an open conversation, and I think we'll have different societies come up with different balances.
Since Donald Trump became president, has that at all changed the way you think of what you're doing and how you're doing it and why you're doing it and where you're backing up your data?
What's going on now in the political sphere is not changing how we're thinking of, but boy, it puts a lot more fire under our butts about, let's do it better. Let's make sure that we're doing our job really well. And people are volunteering out of nowhere. So at the end of every term in 2008 and 2012 and now 2016, we archive everything on .gov and .mil very, very well. But there's a lot more interest this time around, obviously. There's volunteers, there's hackathons, there's people that are doing
doing a lot of work and putting things into the Internet Archive and helping. There's a button on the Wayback Machine page of Save Page Now. So people are doing that up a storm. But we're also expanding now into government data sets, climate change data sets particularly. There have been people that are now in power that have said they want to just have the whole Department of Energy go away, much less the EPA or the NEA and NEH and all of these, you know, major institutions, American institutions, can just be erased. What the taxpayers have paid for should stay around. So we're very motivated and getting lots and lots of help.
So how do you work with the Library of Congress?
Well, yeah, we've got a room inside the Library of Congress where we're digitizing books every day. They contract with us to archive the websites that they're interested in. And we work with the National Archives. And we work with libraries all around the world. We're a major technological part of how these organizations work. It's very collaborative. So we've worked with them where they've got some of the best curators and the best subject specialists, and we've got the technology back end for pulling some of these things off. So they're help select, we do a lot of the work, and then they get copies, and we encourage people to take copies of the materials and make copies in other places. It's the only way to keep the data safe.
I wanted to go back to before the Internet Archive started. So you helped start some companies, and you were kind of a pioneer in thinking about not just how to navigate the Internet, but how to have version control, how to save the history of different versions. And it's interesting that HTTP didn't necessarily have that. I mean, I know that that was quick and dirty and let's get it out there so people can use the Internet. But what do you think that's cost us, or what kind of challenge do you think that's set up in that we weren't doing this much earlier? We weren't saving versions much earlier.
The wonder of the World Wide Web is it's simple and it got out there. But Tim Berners-Lee cut a lot of corners. And there were other systems. I did one called Waze. And it had concepts of original publishers and republishers and versions and even payments and things like that. And it was too complicated and it didn't work as well that the World Wide Web took off. So we've been adapting. And the Wayback Machine tries to deal with however we can. What's kind of exciting right now is both with Firefox and with Chrome, there's now an extension that you can go and augment your browser such that if you hit a 404, document not found, a dead link, it looks it up automatically in the Wayback Machine and says, ah, got you covered. Here it is if you want it. And that kind of thing to fix the web is a good idea. We'd like to take it a step further than that and actually make a decentralized web. Because what we've found because of, you know, revelations of Edward Snowden is the reader privacy aspects of the web really are not what it is one would hope for. You can't be sure that you're not being spied on of what it is you're reading. And that's not good enough. That should be safe and secure to do. And the only way we think to do that is to make a decentralized system such that websites can move around and be hosted in multiple places. So that even if some parts of the infrastructure are destroyed or blocked from your access, that you can still get access to the information resources. These technologies are doable now. So it's going and fixing the web, which was a good start, but it's getting a little long in the tooth. It's looking a little kind of shabby and old. Let's kind of put another generation of life into this public institution that has been a celebration of sharing. I mean, just what level of people are willing to go and pour their lives and their thoughts and their dreams and what it is they know into the web has been fantastic. Let's make sure it lives up to what people expect out of it. And we technologists have not been doing as much. I mean, I think there's been a lot of attention on, just how to make money and make some not terribly exciting, but get an IPO for this is and that and selling this is and that. Let's work on some of the infrastructure of how our society now works as an information platform that's better than Facebook or 140 characters of Twitter.
The decentralized aspect, is that an idea or is that already being done?
It is an idea that a number of people are working on it in different sets of places. in April, Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web, Vint Cerf, inventor of the internet, ourselves, the head of Mozilla, the head of BitTorrent, came together to figure out what should we do next. And some concrete ideas, and there are prototypes now being built towards building a decentralized web that gets around some of the problems that we've seen crop up, but also let's go forward. How do you make it so people can get paid by publishing on the web? We never solved that. There's advertising, but that doesn't work all that well. It makes for winner takes all and very, you know, large scale organizations. How can you make it so a band can sell their stuff without having their stuff on iTunes or in Amazon? Can we make a decentralized web really work? And the answer is yes. We just have to go and spend the time and do it.
So the Internet Archive, it archives material from around the world, from different languages. If the Chinese government comes to you and says, we don't want you to have these things that you have on the web, because we block them in China, and you know, we have the right, we believe in internet sovereignty, and so anything created in China is ours, take it off the Internet Archive, what do you do?
China hasn't come to us with that, but they've blocked us. So if you're a citizen in China and you try to go to archive.org, it just goes nowhere. We're blocked by the Great Firewall of China. And maybe it's over the web collection, but I think it's actually just some of the videos people have uploaded. That's just some things that they don't like. And so we've been blocked in China now for several years. Russia allows access to us again. India, for a while, was blocking us. And we'll see whether the United States starts to block things. I mean, Donald Trump, in some of his campaign speeches, has talked about closing up parts of the internet. We've seen this talk and action in other countries, such as Russia and China, before. So I think we need to move our technologies forward towards having copies in multiple places so that we have reliable access, that the reader privacy is preserved along the lines of how people would expect. Like it was growing up in a library. But at this point, it's pretty easy for law enforcement to go and ask Amazon all the books that I've bought from Amazon. So how do we go and restore privacy aspects that we had a few decades ago?
So at the moment, is storage here? Or is it already decentralized in different places within the states and outside the states?
The Internet Archive has two copies in the Bay Area, a partial copy in Alexandria, Egypt, really, and a partial copy in Amsterdam. And we're now starting to talk with institutions in Canada about their hosting different parts or all of the Internet Archive's collections in Canada. And I think this makes all the sense in the world. The reason why we don't have the Library of Alexandria anymore is they didn't make another copy and put it into India and China. Or otherwise, we'd have the other works of Aristotle, the other plays of Euripides, but we don't. They're just gone. The history of libraries is a history of loss. Libraries are destroyed, and they're usually destroyed by governments. The new guys want it sort of wiped clean. They may be sorry about it 100 years later, but if you didn't have another copy, it's just gone. Let's learn from that. Let's design for it.
What do you consider your biggest challenge at the moment?
We have great materials in our libraries that aren't accessible online yet. We have problems with fake news. We've got echo factories. We do know that people really want to find out what's going on, but you can't get a lot of the materials because they're behind paywalls in academic journals you can't get to, or they're in books, but they're in libraries and they haven't been digitized and made available. I think we've really shot ourselves in the foot. We convince people to turn to their screens, to the web, to answer questions, that it's the Library of Alexandria. There it is. It's the Library of Congress on your desk. But it isn't. The Library of Congress isn't on your desk. You get some stuff in Wikipedia. You get some things from the Internet Archive or Google Books, but you get snippets. This isn't good enough. It's not a way to run a culture. I think what we saw out of the whole election cycle is people were just echoing around what it is they could find. And it just tended to be gossip and just junk.
Do you archive fake news and then like say where it came from? Or do you kind of let that go and just try to separate the wheat from the chaff?
we try to archive everything, and we actually have specific collections of fake news that are built by librarians that have gone and tried to make fake news collections based on some of these published lists. And of course, there's questions and debates, but let's at least make sure that we have the materials easily accessible to researchers. So we absolutely have, and we're talking with technology companies as to how we can help bring reputation systems into play. But at least let's start by making the primary materials available. Let's bring the nonfiction books online. Let's make it so the television materials are easily accessible. Other than the Internet Archive's TV archive, you can't get to what was on Fox News as broadcast. You just can't get it. So we're doing something wrong culturally. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen some of the shocking results of that is people are going to learn from whatever they can get a hold of easily. And if it's just Facebook posts on whatever, that's all there's going to be. And we in the library world and the publishing world have been doing a disservice to the citizens of the world by going and being too protectionist. We should figure out how to make sure we get paid enough. Oh, awesome, great. But let's remember why we're here. We're here to educate and to inform, and we're not doing a good enough job.
So I would say that serious journalists would say the same thing about their work. There seems to be a campaign to sort of try to discredit the media in the minds of the public, which reminds me of when I was living in China. That was something that I was quite used to, except that the Chinese government tried to discredit foreign media, so Chinese people wouldn't take seriously anything that was reported. Do you worry that if any administration, potentially also the Trump administration, decides that somehow the Internet Archive is a threat because it has too much information that it's making available that's potentially damaging or embarrassing, that they'll try to discredit you in the same way?
Gosh, don't know how that will evolve. I think it's just what we've got is we have to do our job, whether we're in the media or we're in the libraries, and our job is to go and make permanently available as good material in context as we can. And it's never been clearer. The great thing is we have people that want to know. So the Internet Archive is the number 300th most popular website. We get on the order of 4 or 5 million people every day using our resources. That's really cool. That is a lot of people wanting to know old stuff. So if we make good information available in context with citations proven in good ways, people will care. Now is our chance. Now is our, we're necessary. So I'd say it's a good time for us. What doomed the Library of Alexandria was starting to be a shift of interest from universal ideas into a much smaller ideas. The Christians of that day that really shrank the interest and the support for libraries. And that is what we want to fight going forward. We like the idea of universal access to all knowledge and education and growth. Let's keep that alive and growing.
As you look at nativist movements that are rising in Europe and Turkey and China and India and elsewhere, it feels like, at least in some places, at least in this moment, there's interest in shifting in that direction. And it might just be a passing thing. But, I mean, for you as a librarian, as someone who values preserving accounts of history and, you know, having as much access as possible to information that can help you understand how we got to the point that we're at and where we might be going, is this a particularly distressing moment for you in that sense?
There have always been pendulums that have swung back and forth, whether it's on a per year or per country basis and the like. I guess it's always sad to see things close up. And what I think we can grow from is we need to make copies in multiple places so that the information survives. So people may not be interested in it for a while, but they'll be interested in it again. And it's challenging in a digital age. Paper lasts 500 years. Palm leaves last 1,000 years. Papyrus, we have papyrus from the Egyptians. But hard drives? Flash drives? Floppy drives? how are we going to make this last? And right now we've got to have these organizations beavering away, copying it forward. We need people in all sorts of areas doing it for their personal, their communities, their national interests, their international, their, how we've got to be, all become archivists. We all have to go and make sure that we care about making it to the next generation. Otherwise, it will be lost.
Are you ready to take that on? Become an archivist, copy it forward, and then copy your copies often so they don't suffer from digital decay or risk getting stranded in an obsolete format? Maybe you already do all that. Maybe you haven't even backed up your own hard drive. Start with that and build out. If you want to check out the Wayback Machine, you'll find it and more about the Internet Archive at archive.org. Very simple. That book I mentioned at the top of this episode, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu by Joshua Hammer, worth reading. A good reminder of how timely efforts to save human knowledge can work. Still, I do wonder how all this will evolve as the sheer volume of what we produce online globally moves from petabytes to whatever comes after that. I wonder whether authoritarian governments will become savvier and more methodical in calling for certain data to be taken down from the Internet Archive, and how that will affect the mission to save and make available all human knowledge. I recognize, as Brewster Kahle pointed out, the importance of navigating issues of privacy while saving as much as possible of what's online. These are some of the challenges shaping this century, and how we all face them will affect whose century it is, in terms of who's empowered by having information, who's remembered and why, and who's telling the story of this century to future generations. The Internet Archive aims to level the playing field and then open it up to all comers. Quietly, beneath the cypress trees, in its home, in a converted church, this group is doing its part to celebrate knowledge in the pursuit of truth, or at least of verifiable facts, available on the archive whenever anyone seeks to find them. Comments, suggestions? Please write to me at whosecentury@gmail.com or send me a note on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. A print version of this episode, with photos from the Internet Archive, is at pri.org/century. And while you're there, browse through previous episodes. There are 39 of them. This is episode 40. Whose Century Is It is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and of course on iTunes and most other podcast apps. Subscribe if you haven't already. And while you're there, please rate us and leave a review. It helps others find the podcast. In fact, if you like the podcast, tell a friend or two about it. It's always nice to have more listeners. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.